Okay, so Croeso, welcome. Episode 91, and it is the Toshak years. We've threatened to do this for a while, and we finally got around to it. I've had fried bananas for tea, dry chicken, couldn't find any gravy. I hid under the table to see if I could find some vegetables, which is a very niche reference to what we're going to be covering. My name is Russell, and via a different platform to usual, so hopefully this is going to go okay. We have Leon. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, Russ. Good to be here for this one.
Gareth, you okay?
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I'm good.
Good. You and I are last 2 weeks winners of our quiz, aren't we?
We are.
Still basking in the glory, yeah?
Yeah, we'll be going head-to-head for the first time this Thursday, I believe.
Yeah,
So pressure's on.
Rumble in the jungle. So, yeah, Toshak years, and I actually surprised myself when I looked back, because we first did this with Terry Orr, we went back through Terry Orr's reign, and that was podcast episode 23, which was done about 5 years ago. Sort of does feel that long, actually. And then we did the Hughes years, which was episode 48. The format of these, if you haven't listened to those, is fairly in-depth, forensic, chronological look, and that's important. It's certainly in this respect of their managerial reigns. And we try to sort of get beneath the surface, then, if you like, of what tends to be the accepted, received wisdom of those managerial reigns. And Leon, you were just saying a minute ago before we started that the chronology of it, but actually that's possibly quite important with respect to Toshak.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Toshak years, there's a real temptation just to talk about what they meant to Welsh football and how they sort of changed Welsh football for the good or for the bad, depending on how you look upon him. And he's very polarizing, obviously, as a whole. And that because that's really where the narrative lies with Toshak years. There's no real sort of drama itself to any of the campaigns because we never got anywhere close to qualifying. But I still think it's worth doing it this way because the gradual introduction of certain players in particular, I think, is an important part of the whole story of that era. So I'd still like to do it chronologically, even if a lot of the football was frankly pretty forgettable. So, see if we can rack our brains and try and remember some of these games.
Going back through it, I have found myself going, oh, yeah, that game. And I was there and, I travelled to it. What books and texts and primary sources, Gaz, as a history teacher, secondary sources, have we been reaching for?
Chris Wotham and Phil Stead books out. Yeah. There's a little chunk on it in by Jamie Thomas,
is
there? Yeah. So I had a quick look at those and browse at a few websites. There's more stuff out there than you think, actually. It's been something that's been quite poured over in writing, if not in podcast form.
Obviously, little wonder.
Of course. Sorry, how could I forget?
quick glance at Dave Edwards' book, Living My Dream, for a player's perspective. Although the players that Chris Waffen interviewed for Together Stronger came out with some really interesting stuff, particularly Danny Gabadon. I dug out Terry Yorov's autobiography as well, because there's just a really interesting little passage in that. Maybe I could read it now because it might kind of set it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And this came out in 2004, so when Mark Hughes was manager. So Yorov wrote, this was just a few months before he was, reappointed manager. And look, and there's also the context here that you bear in mind that there was a bit of needle between Yorov and Toshak because basically Toshak took Yorov's job in 94. Yorov wanted to carry on. The FAW wouldn't give him pay rise. They wanted Toshak to do it on a part-time basis from Spain, commute every few months to do it. I get the impression Yorov was almost sort of glad when it didn't work out that time in 94 because, he kind of still considered it his job. But by a decade later, he wrote, Toshak's contribution to Welsh football as a player and manager with Swansea has been immense, and it could have been a lot bigger. Not making use of his experience of working abroad in Spain, Portugal, Turkey and France is nothing short of an indictment of the people who run football in Wales. Even bearing in mind the sort of negativity between the two men there, I think, you know, there was a feeling by 2004 that then was the time for Toshack to be sort of given a chance to make his mark on Welsh international football and get a kind of different perspective across and use that sort of vast experience that he had gained by that point.
That's fairly honest, isn't it, Billy? Yoruth, to be fair, given the circumstances, like you say, that he took over the Toshack took the job in 94, which we'll come to in a minute. But yeah, go on, guys, sorry.
I was going to say it's worth thinking about those sort of words from Yoruth in the context of him first being appointed in 94 and then again in 2004, because that vast continental experience, well, by 2004, it's becoming dated. He's probably got a fair bit to prove again in 2004. He's been at Besiktas and Catania and Real Murcia. He's had a second spell at Real Madrid. And in most cases, he's had fallouts with boards, fallouts with players, not particularly successful periods at those clubs. So the context when he comes in 2004 to what that experience means is very different to, well, quite different to 1994. And as I imagine we'll come on to later, you know, there's a sense even early on in his reign that despite all of that experience, modern football, 21st century football, has kind of left him behind, but perhaps first team level anyway.
Yeah, so 94 then. So obviously Bowden hits the bar. We don't go to America. Yoruth makes it very clear in the press that he wants to stay on. Not unreasonably, he's apparently asked for a pay rise. He then negotiates that back down. He lowers his demands, but it all gets very messy, doesn't it? And played out in public quite a bit and in the media. Eventually, Toshack is announced, like you say, Leon, part-time, which I can remember that being seen as quite a retrograde step. Two things to my mind at the time was, one, it was a retrograde step because, of course, Yoruth himself had started part-time, had fought to get the job, you know, a full-time post. I suppose the sense that Toshack was getting, having his cake and eating it, and I think he was very surprised at the level of vitriol aimed not so much at him, but at the situation and certainly at the FAW. When he comes to take charge for this game against Norway, it's a friendly, it's at Ninian Park. He was shocked by quite how angry the crowd were. And there's no getting away from it. That performance was pretty dismal. He was quite populist in giving Jason Perry a cap, his only cap. Nathan Blake, his debut as well, obviously, Cardiff players. But he was surprised by all that, which suggested he wasn't really angling for the job for a while or had been doing his work from Spain to see how the land lied. It was pretty unseemly, wasn't it?
It was a mess, really. I just remember watching that game on TV and the crowd was pretty hostile. There was just a lot of ill feeling because Yoruth was so popular. Everything that, you know, Yoruth had been through, really, the previous few years, and with losing his son so tragically at the start of that 94 World Cup campaign. And then the tragedy of the Romania game, really, and its aftermath, and the death of John Hill in the stadium. You know, the Welsh public was right behind Terry Yoruth and really wanted him to stay on. And Toshack had been away for about a decade at that point and perhaps wasn't in tune with fans.
And he was gone within, well, less than a week, I think, of the game. And he walked out citing a dirty war, quote-unquote, in Phil Stead's book of Welsh football politics. I want to wash my hands of the whole affair. Wales can forget about me, which we did, more or less. Maybe Yoruth's, you know, the quote from Yoruth's book there, Leon, you opened with, probably bears that out. So we roll forward, you know, a decade, give or take. And do you know what? He gets the job off the back of another fairly public, protracted, drawn out, unseemly, messy affair where Hughes is, to my mind, indulged, is allowed to string us all along, including the FAW. He's being linked with Blackburn, obviously, a job he ended up taking, but there were other kind of noises around other connections with managerial vacancies. He fancied a pop at England, the Millennium Stadium, and he was hanging on. We had a dismal start to that campaign. So we're into 2004. We draw in Azerbaijan. We have that remarkable game against Northern Ireland, the 2-2. Was it three sendings off, I think? So, yeah, up at Old Trafford, not at the Millennium.
No, we lost to England then, 3-2 against Poland after that.
And yet another campaign where we're chasing the pack almost as quickly as it's begun. So there's some interesting similarities there.
It's difficult to come in to a campaign that was already up and running. I mean, that's just a difference, isn't it? That Hughes stayed on for this campaign, the first four games. He was then doing it part-time for at least two of those games because he'd already been appointed at Blackburn. Whereas, you know, if Toshak had stayed on in 94, he'd have got a bit of a run at that Euro 96 campaign at least. Or whoever, you know, if someone else had been appointed at the start of 94. The big difference is that that campaign was already over, whoever would have taken over after the Poland game, because we'd lost two and we'd drawn with Azerbaijan and Northern Ireland. There was absolutely no chance after those first four results that we were going to get anywhere close to qualifying for the 2006 World Cup. That's a difference, I guess. So if Toshak had taken over, if somebody else had taken over, it was a write-off from that point.
Leon's right that the campaign was written off and we'd had, you know, certainly before the previous campaign and the campaigns before that, quite a few experiences of it being over before it had really begun. But there is a little bit more to the climate then when Toshak takes over, because although we sort of joked a minute ago about having forgotten about him for 10 years, actually we didn't, because he was quite a well-established pundit in Welsh international games and sort of rightly or wrongly became seen as quite a vocal critic of the Welsh team under Hughes. So when he's picking up that campaign after, like you say, Hughes has been indulged, his first job, therefore, effectively, really, is to sort of galvanise that squad, you know, have a few games to galvanise that squad ready for the next campaign, which becomes very difficult given that the reaction of some of those players to him was likely to be more negative than perhaps if an alternative candidate had come in, rightly or wrongly.
Yeah, and it says he's a pundit, I suppose, to a certain extent. In the late 80s, the early 90s, you haven't got the internet and the wall-to-wall coverage of European football, notwithstanding Gazzetta Italia and Scorio, I suppose. But perhaps those of us who weren't aware of his big ego from the 70s as a Liverpool player and as a Swansea manager, that's the point at which, with his punditry, you begin to realise he is really quite prepared to speak his mind and to be very, very critical. And in pundit terms, was actually quite refreshing, given how banal and bland many of them can be, certainly on TV.
I thought he was a really good pundit. I've got to say, I enjoyed his punditry. And even when he was a bit negative, he was usually right. There's a guy who used to post on the Dragon Soccer message board, or it might have been on the Apostle board. He was, I remember this post. He said he always used to kind of hate Toshak for his punditry and sort of shout at the telly and everything like that. Go on about why does he have to be so negative the whole time? And then we went off to Milan to that game at San Siro and we got absolutely thumped 4-0. And he said, oh, he realised then that, you know, to my horror, Toshak was right all along. You know,
we've had six games. Competitive games, we haven't won one, Ollie. Don't look at me like that.
No, I just
mean, that's the way it is.
But we've enjoyed it along the way, haven't we?
I haven't enjoyed it, to be honest with you. I didn't enjoy Milan. I didn't enjoy Belgrade.
Italy here, there was a fantastic
but
night
we're talking
winning
since,
in Helsinki.
We're talking since the 12 points in four games. Have you enjoyed six games, four defeats and two draws? I haven't.
There's a bit, I think it's in Giggs's autobiography, where he says that the players would boo if they saw clips of Toshak on TV while they were in Wales camp. I'm pretty sure it's Giggs's. So yeah, you're right, Guy. There wasn't a huge, potentially wasn't going to be a huge amount of love lost on the part of some players when he gets the job. Savage famously, and I suppose understandably to a certain extent, after Hughes has gone, after that Poland game, makes a bit of a power play for Gary Speed to get the job. And I can see the logic in that. Though Speed himself, I think, said at the time that it would have been too soon for him. And makes it clear as well who he doesn't want to have the job. Again, in true, inimitable Robbie Savage style. And I'm sure we will be returning to Toshak and Savage there's some interesting candidates, I think.
Philippe Troussier.
Gerard Houllier, but Houllier pulled out. And Dean Saunders. So, I mean, it could have been a whole lot worse, frankly. I mean, of those, I mean, Philippe Troussier, from memory, is one of those Bora Milutinovic sort of type characters that crisscrosses the globe, taking international jobs on different continents. So I'm not quite sure how that would have panned out. But if Houllier pulls out and you're left basically between Toshak and a rookie, in the case of Dean Saunders, then the FAW doesn't have a huge amount to go with.
Brian Flynn applied for the job as well, but he wasn't even given an interview.
We talk about speed. Speed retires. He's only 7 caps short of Big Nev's record after that Poland game. Pembridge goes.
Worth saying, actually,
Melville goes.
On speed, he retired after the game. So it was before Toshak was appointed. Yeah. Because it's often said, oh, Toshak came in and then a load of players retired. Well, actually, Gary Speed had retired already. If Philippe Troussier had got the job, or Dean Saunders or whoever, he was retired anyway.
That point about the retirements, that's kind of right. But there's sort of two sides to that. There's often said, like you say, that Toshak has seen his response, Pembridge and Speed and Melville's players retired. Most of those were at an age to go anyway. Pembridge and Speed and Melville are all well into their 30s, and it's an obvious time for their international retirement. There's one or two who maybe not so much, but you know, we don't know the ins and outs of their retirements. But on the other hand, it's also then assumed by people who are more sympathetic to Toshak that the average of the squad was 30, whatever it was. There weren't enough players. Well, actually, there were 16, 17 established first-team squad players between the age of 20 and 30 when Toshak takes over. So he does inherit a squad which is going to have its limitations compared to maybe what Hughes had enjoyed a year or so earlier. But it doesn't necessarily have to be this barren, rip it up and start again thing that is sometimes now seen as.
It was a mixture of a touch of necessity and a choice on Toshak's part to actually go with a sort of scorched earth policy, for sure. It's not black and white on that issue.
Because, I mean, the reality is, like you say, we flunked the first 4 games of that campaign, but, of course, we had flunked the end of the previous one. And although I think in hindsight, I covered this with the Hughes years episode, those friendly results that we get between those two qualifying campaigns probably glosses over some of the other problems that we had in that squad, and certainly glossed over the tactical limitations that Hughes had shown, certainly in the playoffs, in the Serbia game, and also a conservativeness on his selection part. So although he begins to blood players like, Paul Parry comes in against Scotland, for example, and some of those sorts of players, I think it's fair to say he's not getting the most out of that squad by the time he decides to take that Blackburn
role. It was
role.
10 competitive games without a win by the time Toshak took over. That's from the Serbia game away until Poland's.
You know, as I've said for a while, and certainly said on that Hughes is a closer scrutiny of his record, I think, betrays some serious kind of flaws and weaknesses in the argument that he was a good manager on the pitch. Off the pitch, there's things around the self-esteem and the respectability and a bit of pride, and I get all of that. But the reality is 10 competitive games without a win is pretty poor by anybody's standards.
But it is then the case that John Toshak, years later, in bad results, talking about the 10 games under competitive games without Hughes when he came in as a sort of almost to justify then some of the failings that had emerged of the first team management. And if it was the case that Toshak took over and he had to completely rebuild the team, that's still relevant. I think given that actually Toshak, which, like you say, Hughes was struggling to get the best out of, but that was still had enough people in it to be a competitive Wales team straight away under Toshak's reign, I think there are those questions around why Toshak wasn't able in those early years, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of the individual campaigns in a minute, to turn things around. I was going to say it more quickly, but at all. And it's also worth remembering, it's not a Hughes-Toshak sort of versus thing. However, that is part of the narrative of that era of Welsh football amongst fans and people who write about it now. And the reality is that Hughes, and Toshak himself, is that Hughes also took over a basket case. Hughes took over from Bobby Gould, and it took him a while to get us through any kind of period of success. But ultimately, he did do that for a time. We talked a little bit about John Toshack being a critic as a pundit. And yes, after the Italy game, I think, fair enough, the example of the fan you quoted. But Toshack is laying into that Hughes team from very early on. You know, after a one-all draw with Norway, quite early on, 5 or 6 games into Hughes's reign. And Hughes at that point is a new being a shamble under Bobby Gould. And as a pundit, he goes after that. And then as a manager, he expects a level of patience and to be able to hark back to Hughes's failings 4 years on, in a way that I think he would have been impatient with as a pundit.
Oh, that's a good point, actually. I think that's perhaps saying something about Toshack's ego.
Yeah.
I think as a manager who'd taken Swansea from the bottom division to top flight and won the league at Real Madrid perhaps he was deserved more slack than a rookie manager like Hughes in his own head, you know. But that, yeah, like I said, that's Toshack's ego, I'm sure.
First game is at the Millennium Stadium. There's only 16,000 there. It's against Hungary. We played them out there, so I think this was like a reciprocal friendly the year after we played them out there in the Hughes, and that turned into quite a bit of a needly match. I think it was Savage and Mateus are having a bit of a scrap and a ding-dong on the touchline. That was a great game. So anyway, they come back over here and he gives debuts to Sam Ricketts, David Partridge, Danny Collins comes on. Stephen Roberts gets his only cap in injury time. Only 2 players with over 30 caps in the starting 11, Bellamy. Can you remember who was captain for the day?
No.
It's a good quick question, this is.
Capital?
No. Only time he captained Wales. It was...
John Hartson?
No. But he was at Cardiff City at the time. He was only there briefly. It was Robert Page.
Wow. Oh,
nice.
Yeah, it's a good quiz question. That comes up on Thursday, but we're dancing. but Gabadon does play. Danny Coyne in goals. Rob Edwards at fullback. Reese Weston comes on. So several of those players that had been quite peripheral under Hughes get their chance. Simon Davis is there. Carl Robinson plays. Bellamy plays very, very well. We win 2. Everything's fine. I think, isn't that? That's not how it goes. What are we looking at? We then have the other part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire the following month, twice in a week, which was a bit of a weird doubleheader. Yeah. Home to Austria and away to Austria. I don't remember much about the home game. The away game I went to, and we were really good that night. We played with pace. We were fluid. We ripped them to shreds. And then Danny Coyne let in one of the worst goals I've ever seen with about 2 minutes to go or something. And that was ever so frustrating.
Yeah, I wrote a piece before we played Austria in Vienna a few years back. 2016, wasn't it? 4 years back. The history of Wales. I mentioned that doubleheader. And I said basically that away game, after we'd kind of lost very limply at home to a really average Austrian team, we went out there and sort of really gave it a go. And I said that game basically summed up Toshack's time in charge of Wales, because there was lots to admire about that performance, but in the end, there was absolutely nothing to show for it because we lost the game. Giggs and Bellamy played up front together.
Yeah.
And they were both excellent, except for their shooting. They carved out a lot of chances for themselves. They just couldn't put them away. And it was just like sort of bad luck that we didn't get anything from that game, really, because we were better than Austria. We were, you know, tactically superior as well. You know, Toshack set the team up well, even though we didn't have a particularly experienced defence, from what I remember of that game, and an inexperienced goalkeeper in Danny Coyne, which sort of cost us in the end.
Am I right in thinking that it's between the Hungary friendly and the first of those 2 Austria games that Savage's retirement comes? So he doesn't play in the friendly, but then he gets left out of the squad for the 2 Austria games, and the sort of ensuing spat and retirement happens then.
No, you're right. He turns up for camp for the Hungary game, carrying a groin injury. According to him, he is the only one who stands up on behalf of the players to query the cuisine that is made available. Both the size of the portions, the type of food, the range of food is not as wide or as broad as it was under Hughes. And he calls that out. Toshack then phones him up to say that he's going to try something different for the Austria games. And Savage basically tells him to stick it where the sun doesn't shine. Which, by his own admission, I think afterwards, he recognises that he essentially gave Toshack all of the ammunition to then not pick him ever again. I think Savage kind of recognised that in the end.
One of the most entertaining bits in Toshack's recently released biography is his description of Savage. Basically, Toshack knew from the start. He didn't ravage around. Okay, complained about Savage basically complaining for that camp and the Hungary game. Just said, you know, he was just a pest. A personality clash there from the start. And he goes on to say something like, "I didn't like him as a player anyway. You got the feeling he thought it was all about him out there. He wasn't disciplined." So basically, Robbie Savage was just not in John Toshack's thinking at all.
I have a little bit of sympathy with that view of him, actually. Go on, Gary.
Yeah, I can understand some sympathy with that, but it is easy to have a go at Robbie Savage because he's a bit of a dick. But there's kind of two issues with Toshack's view of things there. The first one is that by 2004, by the 21st century, football is changing. And I probably wouldn't have said this at the time, but I'm afraid I'd have to admit it now. The job of a first team manager is to manage players' egos and personalities and the way they behave. And that's especially true, I think, of something like a Welsh international setup, where our pool of players is always going to be limited. I think however much Toshack is right broadly on Savage's limitations as a player, he is our only, at that point, established English Premier League central midfield player, who at that point is only 30, and who, Mark Hughes for all his problems, was pretty good at managing, pretty good at sort of getting him to play for him. And other players who we maybe respect a little bit more, like Gary Speed themselves, commented on how it was a little bit disappointing to see Savage out of the squad at that point, because he was established Premier League player. And I think given that what follows on from that in the years, it becomes harder and harder to get players to turn up. Well, the realities behind them are shared by a lot of those players. But a different manager might have managed that situation more successfully and kept one of our few better players. And he was, for his limitations, he was one of our better players on board for another 3 or 4 years, because he was still playing at least championship level 4 years later.
He said something like Robbie Savage was our only Premier League central midfielder at that point. Well, Gary Speed was.
He'd retired.
Yeah. But I mean, he was Welsh and he was still only in his own early 30s. Like we said before, he had retired prior to Toshack taking the job. I just think we missed Gary Speed going for those next 3 or 4 years. We certainly missed having quality players in central midfield, but I think Gary Speed was the player that we missed more than Robbie Savage. And I thought it was just a real shame that Speed retired when he did.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that, Leon. Although Speed played on quite late. I mean, he was already at least 33 by that point. And again, maybe it speaks to whether, I mean, it's a very hypothetical question, whether it speaks to a manager who didn't have the baggage of the unpopularity with Speed, Giggs, and some of Savage and some of those other players from the Hughes year, whether someone picking up the phone to Gary Speed and saying, "Look, I really see an important role for you in this squad," whether that might have sounded better to Gary Speed coming from someone else. And the fact is, Gary Speed, like you say, had already made his decision to retire. And at his age, that was a reasonable thing, notwithstanding the fact that he played on longer than most.
There's one other player who we're missing. So I agree with Leon. I think that we missed most, for whatever reason, was Speed. I think he would have still had a huge amount to offer. But the other player who I think we're really, really missing is Mark Delaney, who is still... So he played in the game in Vienna. He's still at Villa. He's still playing, but he's beginning to struggle with injuries. And you just look at the right backs that we were picking. Reece Weston, for example. Sam Ricketts played both sides defence. A fit, healthy Mark Delaney, I think, would have made a huge amount of difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly in that wing back 3-5-2 preferred formation. To have him bombing up and down the right wing would have been brilliant. But
I think we really struggled at fullback for a long time and for nearly the entirety of Toshack's reign, really. Until the sort of very end, you know, it's just a real problem position for us for a long time. As we move on, I'd like to say a bit more about that.
We face Slovenia in one of those really, do you know, I don't see that. I'm not sorry to see the back of those August friendlies, but they were like a week, 2 weeks into the season.
Yeah.
Invariably rubbish. The games were dreadful. Although we did wear that black cap at games, the only thing I remember of it. And it was the first game at the Liberty, first international at the Liberty. And then a month later, we have England at home. My abiding memory of that is being behind the goal for the Paul Robinson save from John Hartson, which is in my kind of top few saves I've seen in a stadium ever. But we lose 1-0. Again, we were a bit limp, not to the same extent we were at Old Trafford, but we didn't really lay a glove on them, did we?
No, I really remember that chance as well. And I watched in a pub in, I think it might have been Overton, near where I grew up, when it left Hartson's head. Everyone thought it was in, but it was a fantastic save from Paul Robinson, really was. The only chance I remember is having in that game. But it was a very young team out there. We did at least keep it competitive because, you look at the two team sheets and you kind of think, oh, could be in for a drubbing here. But it was more competitive than the game at Old Trafford, for sure, when we had a much stronger team out, actually, because we had those experienced players. So maybe that was a kind of early sign that Toshak, tactically at least, he had some pretty good ideas because we kind of contained England for long periods and with some pretty inexperienced lower league players like, Richard Duffy and David Partridge playing that game and Ricketts.
Two Carls played. No, you're right. Dave Partridge played, started. Duffy was at right back, Ricketts at left back. You had Partridge, Page and Gabaidon, middle of defence. Collins came on for Page. Midway in the second half. We then went up to Poland and I think we wore black again. Lost 1-0, but injuries are affecting players. So there's no Bellamy, for example. I can remember on the board, the argument would be around, Jason Price deserved a call-up or why wasn't my favourite? Why wasn't Mike Flynn getting a chance? And you begin to think, well, actually, I don't think there was a huge pool to choose from. And I think if you actually counted at that point the number of full-time professional Welsh qualified players who weren't either sort of 17 and completely raw or who weren't 37 and still playing like Andy Melville or whatever. I think our pool of players, I'd be amazed if it got even close to three figures, which I think is a much bigger kind of structural issue with how we develop players in Wales or how we used to. Those days were great. Yeah. Why didn't Mike Flynn get a chance? And Jason Price and I can't remember some of the others now. Avion Williams deserved. I mean, he'd get a call up under Hughes, admittedly, but players like that.
Yeah, to be fair, if you're watching David Partridge playing for Wales, like if you're Jason Price, then you've got to think, or if you're Mike Flynn, you've got to think, well, I've got a chance here as well.
The point I guess I'm making is that the pool from which to choose, a match day squad of 18 or you're 22 or 23, whatever it is for a squad call up. I don't think we had a huge amount of talent beyond that to choose from. And yet, whereas you look at that now, the picture now, and there is clearly more professional players. Yeah. I'm not saying international standard. Clearly, there's a big, big difference. And not just playing in England, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got them playing different places. So.
But that's kind of where Flynn came in. Brian, not Mike. And that was really, his remit was go out there and broaden the pool. Find me the best kids and I'll give them a chance early and go out and find Welsh qualified players. Go and ask questions and find me players with Welsh grandparents because we need them. You just made it clear then. We just don't have enough players. If we're going to just pick people who are born raised in Wales.
We win in Northern Ireland. That was quite a good game. That was one of those games we thought, might it be happening here? Because then we go and beat Azerbaijan at home. Okay, wasn't a great game. But suddenly two consecutive qualifying wins, having gone the best part of 2 years without, with barely a sniff of one. Are his ideas beginning to take hold?
I'm not sure if there was anything particularly significant about that Northern Ireland game in Belfast, but I just remember watching it on telly and really enjoying the game. It was a real ding-dong battle. It was like a sort of old home international game from when I was a kid. It's quite an old school kind of game, mistakes, and there was some poor play, and there was five goals. It was, three, we go two goals up, miss a penalty from what I remember, should have been cruising, and then Gigg scores a really great kick. And I enjoyed that. And I hadn't really enjoyed a Wales game quite a while. I don't know if it's like a corner turned at that point or anything. I'm not sure it was significant. It was just a very enjoyable match.
I don't think it was a corner turned at that point. I mean, from that point on, we're then not going to beat an international team of any significance for nearly 2 years after that. And there are a lot of pretty low points. You know, we were a few games maybe away from the point at which it becomes harder and harder to put a team and even a squad together. But I don't remember any signs emerging towards the end of 2005 that this was a project that was really underway.
Certainly not that we go to Cyprus, we lose 1-0, but frankly, it could have been 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Lewis Price makes his debut and has an absolute blinder. And again, it's more of the same sort of players. David Cottrell's now come in and got a couple of caps. Gavin Williams, and it's those sorts of fringe players. David Vaughan's beginning to establish himself as a starting player, or as an alternative starting player to one of the Carls.
We mentioned him already, Robert Page. Now, I know by this point he wasn't, or he never really was, a really top-level player. But he retired, I think that's his last game, the friendly in Cyprus. I think he'd played in the England game just before that, and his international career came to an end. And he's one who, although it was the start of a natural transition out of the team for him, he's still a championship level footballer, and he probably could have given the squad another 2 years to have that bit of experience in it. And I think further down the line, you know, and those managers who are the benefit of this era, I can't imagine now your Chris Gunters and your Ashley Woods in earlier than they need to. They were going to turn their back on the squad even if they were not in the first team. And I think the Savage case was one thing. That was maybe a different personality spat. But I feel like right through this era, you get players who maybe aren't brilliant players, but could be decent, valuable squad members at a time when we really are desperate for all the decent level players with a bit of experience we can get our hands on. A lot of players, Kumas will do it later and Paul Parry will do it later. They walk away 2 or 3 years before they did too. I don't know if that's a reflection on Toshack or not. It doesn't help the problem that continues to exist then through the Toshack era of having to chuck so many young or not good enough players in.
Would you go back and ask them to come back? And I say to you, no, never. Never, never. And maybe that's a fault of mine. But my pride, if you like, I would never, ever do that.
I think that's an interesting point because the argument against Toshack is, of course, that he fell out with the players and everybody retires and everything else. Actually, maybe one of the few players that probably lends that some credence is one of the players that very rarely gets mentioned, which is Page. So that's a really interesting point. And of course, by him retiring, necessitates a debutant in the next game in 2006 home to Paraguay. That's an interesting point. But I think looking at this lineup now for this Paraguay game, and you know the most experienced players left are Giggs, it's Davis, Bellamy clearly, Gabidon, 25, got Paul Jones is back in between the sticks. With the exception, I would say, of clearly Bellamy, those are the sort of players that I would say have the same sort of character then as, for example, the two you just mentioned then, Gaz, in Ashley Williams and Chris Gunter. They're not those dominant, assertive personalities who are prepared to sort of, you know, fight for their place, and they have an importance and they play a critical role in the squad over and above what they do on the pitch. And that's when it begins to happen with this era of Toshack, is it lacks this ability. And there's, you know, Gabidon's one of my favourite defenders, you know, I've ever watched. But he was not a big quality. He wasn't that kind of shouter, that natural leader, which again is another point as to why the captain's armband being rotated any number of players under Toshack, as well as because of the fluctuating availability of players. But those players that you, and I think Toshack needed, we began to lack some of those. And some of those really might have become it. James Collins, for example, they're still relatively raw and inexperienced at this level.
Another thing I'm not sure I ever realised it had happened at the time, I don't remember it, but I read about them today, was at the start of 2006, just before that Paraguay game, on the back of that sort of last campaign, the poor result in Cyprus, and there were a lot of pullouts a few months ago. I wrote to 36 of the players in and around the Welsh squad. This is what I'm demanding of you. You need to be turning up. You need to not let your teammates down. Sort of rallying call. I don't know, maybe that speaks to this misjudgment at how you get those players to buy in and want to keep turning up and wanting to keep playing. Players necessarily heeded that call.
Mm-hmm. There might have been a bit of cynicism there from the players towards Toshack. He would come to the UK and watch players on a fleeting basis. And so if you're you know, a player who's like living, I don't know, where, Derby County or whatever, and you've got this guy just sort of turning up, picking his squads, and he's asking you for commitment, and you're seeing this guy, and you might well be thinking, well, commitment, you live in a different country.
David Cottrell's one of the players who gets interviewed, I think it's in Chris Wotham's book, and he, as one of the younger players, talks about being quite wowed, although he maybe didn't, you know, understand Toshak's history in the game as well as some of the older players might have. Doesn't he talk about being quite wowed? Oh, this guy was at Real Madrid, but then gets a little bit sort of disillusioned as he starts to think, well, if this guy was at Real Madrid, why isn't training better? You know, why isn't the arrangements around the first team quad more efficient, more effective, like relatively middling club level, he would have been experiencing? I can sort of understand why it was would have been a bit of a difficult Toshak to manoeuvre the squad through the second half of that campaign that was already over and into 2006. We really would have wanted a sense in the first half of 2006 that there were now these players coming through who were going to play alongside, you know, the few more established players we had left, and they were going into that next campaign believing we could do something. But the expectations at the start of the Euro 2008 qualifying were so low. That was a shame so soon into his tenure.
That's quite a telling quote, isn't it, from Cottrell? Because the noises are coming out of the squad quite routinely now about how they're bored, there's not enough stimulus, they're confined to camp. There's players sort of sneaking out to get, is it, I think it's chocolate, isn't it? Someone's talking about they go out to get chocolate because they're still not happy about the food. And there's a sense that it's this, oh no, international windows come around again, which puts your team and your squad on the back foot before it starts. And you know, again, maybe it's an unfair comparison, but contrast that to now, we've had players injured but still turning up and coming along, and that sense of camaraderie and that desire to be there. It's almost like a race to get to camp, or certainly there was under Coleman. It's quite telling.
That thing about breaking curfew to go and get chocolate, it makes you think, well, okay, if this guy's a bit old and he's not really up on the sports science and the psychology of it all and the new training methods, fair enough, he's old school. The one thing you do expect of these sort of old school hard man managers is at least they've got sort of tough discipline then. The idea that like Earnshaw and Gabberdon would have snuck out together and break curfew under Hughes or anyone would do that under Coleman seems, I don't know, laughable, you know?
I can only imagine what players got up to in the Hughes playing era, mind, under Mike England and Yorath.
Well, yeah, that's something entirely different.
Hard to actually be on the Pat Van Den Hout slot of the last one, isn't it? What they used to get up to.
Absolutely.
Round about this time, before we get into the year 2008 qualifying, we play that game against Asks, don't we?
Yes. The only competitive away game that Ryan Giggs ever played in.
Indeed it was. That's right.
It's the only away friendly that, yeah, Ryan Giggs ever played, and it wasn't a capped game. So he never played an official friendly away from home in 16 years of international football.
And of course, because that game wasn't capped, it doesn't tend to figure on the official sort of statistics, appearance statistics. So can you remember then when he made his 1,000th appearance? And of course, a lot of people in England and certainly in the press we're essentially counting it a game too late in respect of that Basque friendly. I mean, notwithstanding, they were also kind of counting the British Olympic appearances, which I'm not quite sure because that was under 23. If that counts, does under 21s count? And anyway, whatever. But strange game. Clyde Anger makes his debut in that goalless draw. He's our youngest Welsh international breaking whose record? Quiz question time.
Brian Green, right. Well,
Brian Green. Well done. Not the other Ryan who's playing that night.
I was listening to the latest, it might not have been the latest actually, listen to the Ellis James podcast, and there was a bit in that where they were talking about how we didn't play many friendlies when Chris Coleman was manager, and Ewan Roberts goes, it's not like Ryan Giggs, Ryan loves a friendly. Got to say, that really made me laugh, that comment, considering as a player.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a contrast in his attitude towards friendlies as a manager and to as a player actually. It's quite ironic.
But of course, you know, you referred to that letter that he sent round to the players, Toshak. There were accusations about Toshak in his playing days, about his attitude and commitment to Wales. I mean, again, a player notoriously almost injury prone himself, to be fair. But then I guess there's all sorts of paradoxes and inconsistencies between, you know, people as players, people as managers. And the one that comes to mind is George Graham, you know, almost kind of the patient of that strict disciplinarian, built his teams on a strong, dour defensive foundation. Yeah, wasn't it? Well, the Arsenal player said he was the laziest trainer, you know, really bad at the discipline side of things in the 70s. So, you know, I guess there's lots of those sorts of inconsistencies, and maybe the Giggs friendly one is another one of those.
So in that case, I don't know if this has ever registered with me before. It must be quite a famous thing. Lua Nyatanga only holds that record for one capped international, because if the Basque game's not capped when Gareth Bale's on the bench, Nyatanga does play. Gareth makes his debut in the next game.
He does. Right? So the record is broken in two consecutive games, but comes on in the next one against Trinidad, who are obviously World Cup bound. They are training for the tournament in Germany, just over the border in Austria. I think they were training in Graz as well. I think that was where their camp was, which is why, is why the game was there. Yeah.
Here's a quiz question. I don't think it was named that at the time that we played that game there and Gareth Bale made his debut. But do you know which famous Austrian that stadium in Graz was at one point named after?
I can't think of too many famous Austrians, and I can't imagine it would be Hitler, so I'm going to have to go for...
Yeah.
Is it Arnie?
The Arnold Schwarzenegger Stadion. Seriously.
Nice.
Yeah, no, according to this, well, I've got in front of me here, it was the UPC Arena.
What happened was when he became governor of California, he wasn't prepared to repeal a death penalty in California, and there was big uproar about that. And when he first basically signed off on the first person to go to the electric chair, they decided they didn't want the stadium named after him anymore and changed the name.
I see, right.
Bizarre little
there we go.
Tidbit for you there.
I actually sought out a YouTube clip of Schwarzenegger not so long ago of him speaking German. And it's really weird because, I mean, it's not weird. I mean, that's his first language, but...
No, it is weird.
I think just culturally...
It's weird.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay, it's weird. But culturally, you just hear him speaking English with an Austrian accent.
Yeah.
It's really strange watching him speaking German.
There's a little story about that, actually. We're digressing here, but anyway, it's quite interesting. When films get shown in the German-speaking world, they're overdubbed into German, and it's very, like, cleverly done, so you can't really kind of see the gaps. It's like, it's a real skill. So they make it look like the actor is actually speaking these words in German. For the German-speaking world, you'll have an actor who does Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt or, you know, whoever for every film, because the audience is used to that voice.
Okay.
And when Schwarzenegger made Terminator, he offered to actually do the German overdub for Terminator and was turned down by the German producers, because he sounded so stupid speaking German. He just sounded like a farm boy from Graz and just not hard enough to be Terminator. So somebody else, another German-speaking actor, overdubbed Schwarzenegger in the Terminator.
Yeah. So as an interesting sideline, just look out for Arnold on... Arnold, yeah, let me and him are big mates. Mr. Schwarzenegger on YouTube speaking German, because it is weird. It shouldn't be, but it is weird. Where were we? I think this is a first in the history of the internet that we've gone from Lua Nyatanga to Arnold Schwarzenegger within seconds.
Bale's debut, yeah.
Bale's debut, that's right. Alongside his former Southampton junior teammate Aaron Davis, two Cardiff boys.
Mm.
Four European cups between the two of them. Who are the two goalkeepers that make their debut? Half each.
Someone like Glyn Garner.
It's not somebody like him, it is him. Well done.
I'm not even sure I realised that was really a goalkeeper, but the name sounded familiar.
Jason Brown?
Yeah, it's Jason Brown.
What, did they do, play half each?
Yeah, so Brown started and then Garner came on. Garner didn't win another cap, I don't think. It's a great list.
That's why I remember him. We must have done him when we did One Cap Wonders. I knew there was a reason he must have been in my head.
There's three West Ham players play in the starting lineup. So it's Gabbard and Collins, Carl Fletcher is West Ham. You've got Yeovil, which is Aaron Davis. Crewe, which is David Vaughan. Orient, which is Glyn Garner. You've got Hellas Verona, which was Craig Davis. Gillingham. It's that kind of definitive ragtag selection of clubs. Everton with Simon Davis. And then some kid called Gareth Bale at Southampton. Yes. Were you in Austria at that point?
Late 2009, I moved over. I remember listening to this game on the radio. We have quite a good record against these teams after the World Cup, and they're about to play England or Scotland. And we often do better than England. We do often do better against Scotland. Phil scoring on his debut to Iran in 1970. That was a win facing Scotland in the 78 World Cup. And they drew that game against Scotland. We beat them in Tehran. We beat Costa Rica in 1990, Gary Speed's debut. They beat Scotland in the 1990 World Cup. And then we beat them. Who else did we beat? Drew with Paraguay in 2006. So they weren't a bad team. And, you know, it's not a bad result to beat them with an experienced team. And Dennis Torrance might well have been the first Wrexham player to play. I'm not sure about it.
This is chock full of really niche trivia. First Wrexham player to play a World Cup. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. Another one of those dreadful August friendlies that are 0-0 against Bulgaria, and of which I remember nothing other than Berbatov. I mean, again, Berbatov doing that thing where he looked completely disinterested. He barely moved, but was still liquid. We lose to... I thought we were unlucky in the Czech Republic. We lose 2-1 as a late winner for them. And it's the same old weird game then against Brazil at White Hart Lane, which I went to. It just seems to take an age to drive to get up there on the coach, is my abiding memory.
Oh, God. There was all sorts of transport problems. I couldn't get on the tube. They were all packed, and I had some sort of issue with the transport, so I missed the start of the game, but there were loads of people who were sort of coming in like all the way through the first half. I remember that. Yeah, a lot of them missed a really good performance in the first half, because I thought we were excellent first half. It was a really entertaining match, and then he took Giggs and Bale off at half time, and obviously Brazil just sort of dominated from there on. But first off, we were great.
There was a great bit, my abiding memory of this, and I think I've said this before, is you've got sort of Bale then playing sort of left back or left wing back. You've got Giggs playing wide left, and it was Niatanga playing left of three centre backs with Collins and Gabadon alongside him. And at one point, they do this little kind of left footed triangle between the three of them around Ronaldinho, and the three of them really mugged him off, and he didn't like it at all. And it was right in front of us, the Welsh fans, and I just remember thinking, hang on, this Bale and Niatanga, if they've got the brass farthings to do that to probably was, I guess, the top player on the planet at that point, then that speaks volumes for their potential. But yeah, the game just ran away from us in the end, didn't it?
Yeah, Giggs was superb first half, I've got to say. That's probably actually the best I've seen Giggs play live. Bearing in mind that I didn't see any games at the Old Arms Park, you know. So I didn't see some of those early appearances, in the flesh, as it were. I remember he had a chance for Earnshaw. He just barely looked, and he just put the ball in exactly the right place. And it was a joy to watch in that first half. He just seemed to be having a lot of fun out there, and the Brazilians were quite, it was quite interesting. They sort of like were really, Ronaldinho was really sort of smiling along with Giggs. And it was actually a really fun game to be at. But I hadn't seen the Trinidad game. So that was my first experience of seeing Bale play. And he just turned 17. And you knew for sure right from the start that he was a proper player. You know, with Niatanga, it was like, maybe. But with Bale, you just knew that he was a guy who sort of belonged at the top level.
There were already noises about him moving, wasn't there, leaving Southampton by this point?
When did he move? I mean, this was 2006, so he stayed on another season at Southampton, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I know a Southampton fan, and obviously they'd been tipped off that this lad was coming through long before he actually did. And, you know, they said, there's no way we're going to keep him. There were scouts down there all the time. I think it was at that time that Southampton were considered a good club to be at as well, to get game time. They'll look after you well and nurture that talent. No, he was great that day. And then we had turned to Cardiff and could be Czech Republic, and then we had Slovakia. Who knows what damage the two of them would have done to us if they'd have still been unified. Paul Jones gets a haircut. That hasn't aged well. It wasn't great at the time, but it's really not aged well, is it?
You've got to be really certain about what you're doing when you do that. I think if you're playing for Real Madrid against, you know, someone from three divisions lower in a cup game, you can be fairly confident that you're going to come out of it looking okay. But any game for Wales is not a time to start doing funny things to your hair, because the game go wrong for plenty of reasons, beyond just how stupid you look with a ridiculous haircut.
Unless you're Aaron Ramsey ahead of Euro 2016.
Absolutely. An exception that proves the rule.
The joke being that Paul Jones almost got the score right in his hair. As a side, actually, to Paul Jones, to give him some credit, that was his 50th cap, obviously. And he didn't make his debut till the age of 30. So you begin to think, if he'd actually even had 5 years of international football in his 20s, he'd have won an absolute ton of caps. I mean, you know, Neville Southall would have been his competition for a significant part of those 20s, but no. That's not a bad effort, to be fair to him. To get the 50, despite being in his 30s, it sort of gives me hope of all sorts of things, good things still to come. My abiding memory of that game, beyond Paul Jones's goal for most of the goals, is that we didn't play that badly, which it seems a really weird thing to say when we were 3-1 down at half-time and 4-1 down after only 50 minutes and 5-1 down after 59 minutes. It was a strange old game, that one.
Again, coming back to those books we've all been reading in preparation for that, it's that time where on interview, people like Gabbardon are saying, you know what, we weren't getting tactically prepared for these games. We weren't identifying the threats. Yes, we were trying to move forward with this more possession game, but there wasn't the tactical preparation to go with that. And you can play okay, but if you're not astute tactically and know what to expect from Slovakia and set up to play that Slovakian team and know what their dangers are, I think at the international level, they are going to score goals, and sooner or later, someone will put a ton of goals on you. I can remember feeling at that time, because Slovakia are one of those teams like Slovenia have been at some time and Montenegro and other times, where they're not teams whose players are playing top level football. Yes, they're technically good. Those teams qualify for tournaments every now and again. Why is that never us? And in those sort of games, you get your answer, because we're tactically naive, we're poorly set up, and there's no doubt in my mind that whatever the limitations of our squad, we had a 1-11 to compete at home against Slovakia, and we got embarrassed. Of course, it's famous for the scoreline. But Toshak himself taught the reaction to it being sort of sensationalist. But we'd lost 5-1. We hadn't lost that badly at home in 98 years. You know, that's how bad it was. And it was embarrassing. And it was another campaign, you know, sort of over pretty much before it had begun.
It was bad. I'm not going to disagree with Gareth there, but to a certain extent, getting an absolute hat at home, well, actually getting a hammering like that anywhere, was kind of a one-off in that during this sort of era, we draw with the Czech Republic. A little bit later, we went away to Germany and we drew, and we were competitive in games against Germany and Russia and the Czechs. So as embarrassing as that was, I've heard people say at certain times, Toshak era was terrible, we used to just get hammered all the time. Well, I don't actually remember that many hammerings. That was the one that I really remember. And it wasn't good, but I do think to a certain extent it was a one-off.
In a sense, I mean, we'd lost to the Czech Republic just before, and we were kind of another group we were chasing. And then we'd do what we, not that we are stuffed so much in the Toshak era, but it would be like one step forward, two steps back. So
yes.
by the end of that campaign, we've got the sort of 5-2 win back in Slovakia. We've kind of restored some pride. And then when we go into the next campaign, we have a couple of half-decent results against some not very good teams to start, and up and it's all over again. The thing is that we never get any momentum behind a campaign. So that's got to be partly on the manager to sort of galvanise this campaign. I was listening to Danny Gabbardon talk on something else the other day, and he was saying a first campaign, a full campaign of Chris Coleman's, which had some disastrous results in it, the players came back at the start of the 2016 qualifying campaign. They just felt, in a way he was speaking, that there was something there that they could buy into. And I don't seem like at any point Toshak was able to galvanise the squad at the start of a campaign. And that's partly due to all the things we've talked about, you know, the retirements along the way and the young players having to come through. But I don't think any of those things explain some of these ridiculous results we get every now and again. You know, whether they're thrashings like the Slovakia game or just wins against teams that we should be putting away easily, like Cyprus or whoever else, you know?
That is the one, and I agree with Leon to the extent that is a, I think it was a freakishness about that result in comparison to the performance. I don't think we warranted a 5-1 defeat. Paul Jones didn't have a great game. But like, you're absolutely right, guys, it's that one step forward, two steps back. You think, okay, well, we've done okay there. We've put in a promising performance. You know, we'd been dreadful against Cyprus previously. We then go and beat them in a qualifier. So if you're going to be dreadful in a game against Cyprus, do it in a friendly rather than the qualifier. Grind out a goalless draw in Northern Ireland. We then go to Croke Park and we just don't turn up. That game reminded me a little bit of the Old Trafford game, albeit that was under Hughes, not Toshak, where, you know, these are players they play against week in, week out. They're familiar with them. We're insipid. And did get a sense that Toshak for those games where we're against a country that has probably got, you know, similar level of resources. Exactly like you say, guys, you know, you see these teams at tournaments, you think, well, hang on a minute, the level that their players are at aren't hugely different to ours, and just couldn't really fire us up. And I think it comes back to that point that you're making, is that the players clearly didn't believe in what he was trying to do, so that when it's not going well for you on the pitch, you've at least got that to fall back on. And that was lacking on the part of a great number of players. I'm sure the young players clearly would have been very grateful for their manager giving them the chance as opposed to other players. I think that's a recurring theme at this era, throughout his era, particularly at this point. But that Croke Park game was horrible.
That says it all. I mean, Steve Evans, you know, fair play to him. Okay, he was Wrexham League Two at the time, was the best player on our team. It was an appalling match. What was bizarre about it was that it was like at Croke Park, so it was 80,000 people there watching fucking conference stand game, because Ireland were poor too. We were just worse. I felt almost embarrassed to be watching it because it was that awful. And that was kind of the first point where I started to feel a little bit angry towards Toshak. And I think a lot of fans had hit a sort of breaking point before that, but that was where I was thinking, I don't know, this guy really, if things are really going to improve and lie at some point, because that was just abject.
It was. No, I agree with you. That was the point to which I've given him a chance, I've bitten my tongue, I've bided my time. No, if we can't even turn up for a game like that, then there is something wrong. And I suppose began to, I say, believe what some of the players were saying about camp and about the attitude. I'm not sure if believe is the word, but that's the point where I thought, yeah, there is something not quite right here.
You could point to the fact that our players maybe don't play first team football regularly. But then again, you could point to the Montenegrins who play well. The standard that they're playing, some of them, isn't that great to prepare for international football anyway. So it must be something when they come together. And the brightness and the passion and the enthusiasm doesn't always seem to be to the fore for me. La, 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 la,